Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between Wall Street and the White House? And to what extent do those with the most money and political power influence one another? Since the early 20th century, a small number of American families with multi-generational ties to one another have had outsized roles in both banking and politics, helping to build and protect the too-big-to-fail institutions at work in the modern economy. My guest today has traced that history and closely examined the way it affects how business is done in America to this day. Nomi Prinz is a former Wall Street executive herself who now works as a journalist and commentator. Her new book is called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Nomi, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris.
This is really interesting because usually these things happen in the opposite way. You say the inspiration for this nonfiction book came when you were working on a novel.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was working on a novel. Well, I finished a novel called Black Tuesday, and it was a fictionalized account of the crash of 1929 and the juxtaposition of the poorer class, sort of the immigrant class, against the banking class, against the Morgan Bank in particular. And I looked at records from the time, newspapers from the time, and so forth as background for the book. But there was a meeting that happened that I talk about in the Black Tuesday, which was between six bankers. They were called the Big Six at the time. Today we have Big Six as well, banks, which are derivations of the legacies of those particular banks in 1929. And there was an afternoon, actually noontime, on Thursday, October 24th, 1929, where the markets were crashing, and the bankers were very, very concerned that their own money, and they all had secrets, and they all had done tricks to make the money they had had up to this particular time, got into a room together, and in just 20 minutes, they decided to throw in $25 million each to save these markets, to restore confidence in them so they could sort of, you know, live another day and prosper and so forth. And it was that meeting that was headed by a man named Tom Lamont on behalf of the Morgan Bank, which was just a stone's throw away from the New York Stock Exchange, where after the meeting, there was calls to buy certain stocks in which they had particular interests and which would help them. And this particular meeting was just very fascinating to me. And the idea that the Big Six then and the Big Six today are so closely related was fascinating, as was the fact that the same Big Six snaked back to the very beginning of the 20th century and during the Panic of 1907. And so I started to look at how presidents at the time were involved in helping and working with these people. And I found, as I started researching all the president's bankers, all of which came out of this particular meeting, that there was a lot of ties, and ones that in every single president's case, from Teddy Roosevelt in the early 1900s through to President Obama, largely individuals, real people, real social ties between the Big Six bankers of any era and the presidents of that era are hugely closely connected, impact policy and impact their social lives as well.
Yeah, the social lives are really interesting because in most cases, the big bankers and presidents have gone to the same schools, have hung out with the same people, have basically run in similar circles.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm just going off of Tom Lamont again, the man in that room. Now, he had a very interesting relationship with FDR. He was FDR's house guest, effectively. He rented out FDR's townhouse in World War I, which was 15 years before the crash in 1929, during the time where FDR was an assistant Navy secretary under President Woodrow Wilson. So at the time, Tom Lamont, who went to Harvard, as did FDR around the same time, also was renting out his house. So they had a very close connection. So by the time it came, the moment to consider what to do with the banking industry in the wake of the crash in 1929 and into the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, which separated the speculative activities of banks from depositors' money, Tom Lamont and FDR had a very tight association already by that point, as did many other bankers of that time who also went to similar schools and who shared, for example, an interest in yachting, as FDR had with a man named Winthrop Aldrich, who ran Chase in the 30s, and they yachted together. The Morgans and the Roosevelts yachted together and lived near each other. So there was a lot of close connections of that nature.
How big a share of the U.S. banking industry belongs to the Big Six as they exist today?
Today, it's extreme, first of all. Big Six banks, which are J.P. Morgan Chase, a legacy bank of that Morgan Bank I was just talking about, so that name exists as the man, J.P. Morgan's legacy, as well as the institution, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and Citigroup, they're the Big Six today, and collectively, they possess 84% of the insured deposits of the citizens of this country that are insured institutions that are backed by the FDIC.
Wow.
That's a tremendous number, 84%. 85% of all the bank assets outside of deposits, so other assets, are owned or controlled by these big six banks. And 96% of the derivatives that get traded out of the U.S. are at the books of these six banks, and 45% of global derivatives, these big six banks. So the amount of power today relative to all the decades in history that I traced in all the president's bankers is immense from the standpoint politically, which it's always been, financially, and the power that that impacts our population because of the concentration of so much capital they have and the way in which we've come to know this idea of too big to fail. It's not just too big to fail from the standpoint of their size, which is bigger than ever before, but also the influence that because of the size is bigger than ever before.
And somehow since 2008, the big six have actually increased their collective assets by nearly 40%.
Yeah, it's crazy, Chris. You know, we had an opportunity, and that's why I mentioned 1933 before. There was a big crash. There was a depression. 25% of people were unemployed. Homes were foreclosed upon. It was a disaster. And the outcome of that disaster was not only did FDR pass the Glass-Steagall Act, which was something that President Herbert Hoover was working on even before, a Republican was working on even before FDR came into office, but he did it with the help, the promotion, the support of the most powerful, one of the most powerful bankers at the time, Winthrop Aldrich, who for two decades after that ran the Chase Manhattan Bank, now part of J.P. Morgan Chase. Today, in the wake of that 2008 subprime crisis, these banks have become bigger, and there's been no accountability, not with respect to crimes they may have committed, to fraud they may have committed, but also to the size that they possess. The fact that in the wake of the subprime crisis, they became bigger by design. They became bigger by political influence out of Washington, not just by the desires of the men running these banks to become bigger, but it was a political financial alliance that made them bigger. And that's what we're dealing with today.
Well, let's go back to the start of all this. First of all, in the early 20th century, how did bankers sort of wrest control away from industrialists of the lion's share of economic influence?
Well, at the turn of the century in the 1900s, what was happening was, and this in particular related to J.P. Morgan, as well as a banker named James Stillman, who was running the National City Bank at the time, which was the second largest bank in the country. Today, we know that as part of Citigroup, and First National Bank, which was run by the Baker family, which also now we know is part of what is Citigroup. And at the time, these men, they had been involved in the industrialist activities, but they realized and they began to change their idea of how you could make money in America into this era of what I call financial capitalism, which is the idea that you can make money out of money. So as opposed to sitting there and drilling things or building tracks or whatever it might have been that the industrialists had made their fortune out of, for example, the Rockefeller family or the Carnegie family or things like that, now these bankers were coming on and they're saying, you know, we can take money out of this and we can have the money work for itself rather than the production of using that money be the thing under which there's labor or under which we're operating. And so this shift happened, and it was exacerbated in the panic of 1907, where J.P. Morgan was asked by Teddy Roosevelt, who was a trust buster, who was trying to actually break up a lot of these industrialists and their outfits at the time, but not banks. He never busted banks. And so this was an area where financial influence really grew, and the individuals who weaned it, who had it, people like Morgan and Baker and Stillman, really pushed it into the White House, and the White House embraced it. Because in the panic situation in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt asked J.P. Morgan to really save the city, to save New York, to save the economy before what he considered a catastrophe, which is a word we've now heard 100 years later, could happen. And J.P. Morgan took $25 million from the Treasury Department, the first instance of a bailout. And he also raised some money from some of his other friends. And he went about saving the banks that he wanted to save, which were his friends, and letting the banks fail that he didn't want to have survive, which were not his friends. And this was the beginning of this notion that you could have a political connection back you. And that from that, the Federal Reserve evolved. So there was a larger bank of banks in Washington that could support the big six banks and their ilk at the time. And so it just became easier to make money out of money. And today it's far easier with all of the globalization we have in finance, the derivatives, all the fancy securities, all the off-book transactions that happen. It's just migrated into an even easier way of making money out of money. But that's how they started. They realized that they had more power that way.
Nomi Prinz is my guest. She's a journalist, formerly a Wall Street executive, and her new book is called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. We'll come back to our discussion in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So we'll talk more with Nomi in a few minutes. If you are interested in this really, really fascinating book, All the President's Bankers, we've got thank you gift copies available when you make a contribution at or above the level of $10 a month at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is with us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And it is the next to last day. It is the second to last day. Tomorrow's the last day of the spring membership campaign, which is great news. And what's really important is that you have an opportunity right now to help out. To help this drive conclude successfully, when you call 888-694-6931 or when you contribute at kera.org. And when you pick up your copy of Nomi Prinz, Prinz's new book, All the President's Bankers, you're automatically entered into a grand prize drawing. This is a pretty great deal, actually, Chris.
Yeah, this is okay. So, tickets to see Neil deGrasse Tyson at the Windspear in the orchestra section. And if you listen to public radio, you know Neil deGrasse Tyson, right? Or we know you would love him.
He was Doogie Howser, right? He was Doogie Howser.
That's Neil Patrick Harris.
Okay, good.
But you know what? NPR people would probably like to see Neil Patrick Harris and Neil deGrasse Tyson.
No,
that would be the ultimate double billing.
I know who he is. I'm just pretending.
This is the astronomer, right? Yeah. Fantastic guy. Also has a great sense of humor.
He's the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Natural History and Science in New York City.
So anyway, he's coming, and we're going to give in this grand prize not only two tickets to see Neil deGrasse Tyson, but along with that is a $1,000 gift card, $1,000 to the Apple Store.
Wow.
And if you make your contribution today, your name, we will place your name, fold it up on a little piece of paper and place it into whatever the vessel is that we're drawing from. And there will be a winner declared, I guess, tomorrow night.
That's a really great opportunity. And you're also supporting your public radio station. Go online to kera.org. You can enter the drawing there. You're automatically entered when you make your contribution quickly, easily, efficiently, safely, securely, and affordably at kera.org, or call 888-694-6931. Want to thank Carolyn Bidwell for her contribution, for her family's contribution. Carolyn says, KERA provides our family with reliable, honest, and non-biased journalism. My husband and I were raised on National Public Radio, and we're proud to support the station that provides so much for our community. And she says, thank you, KERA. Well, thank you, Carolyn, so much. Also, thanks to Zanna Williamson in Plano and Daphne Vol in Dallas, Chuck Rustler in Dallas. Also want to thank Jamie Morgan in Arlington and Aubrey Earl Acosta in Midlothian and Elizabeth Zucker in Dallas.
I want to thank Robert Verdant, who is a Dallas attorney and a friend of KERA. He's issued a challenge, check this out, to encourage listeners to make a contribution today during this show. He's offering to contribute $1,500 to the station if we can raise $10,000 in contributions by 2 o'clock this afternoon. We've got $9,425 left to go. Now's the time when we're looking really at the dollar figure. So any amount that you give would help. But if you are ready to give it a larger amount, that's even more helpful. So go to work for us right now. Put this challenge to work at kera.org or 888-694-6931.
Robert Verdant, a Dallas attorney. He's also a friend of KERA.
Absolutely.
Big fan and supporter of the station. And he's leveraging this challenge to encourage you to give. And as Chris said, we've got $9,425 left to raise. And the $10,000 we've got to raise by 2 o'clock in order to accept this $1,500 additional dollars. So please don't wait. Please call right now, 888-694-6931, or give at kera.org.
You can choose a thank you gift copy of All the President's Bankers by our guest this hour, Nomi Prinz. We'll come back to our interview with her in a couple of minutes. But for now, please go online and support the station at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Nomi Prinz. Her new book is called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Nomi, it was just over a century ago that the Federal Reserve was created, which, of course, has played a big role in regulating the economic system all this time. How did leaders come to agree that something like the Fed needed to exist? And what kinds of benefits did they think it would create for the U.S. financial system?
There were two sides of this idea of benefits. One was coming from the banking community. So after this panic of 1907, the bankers, in particular J.P. Morgan and his friends, realized that they needed something else besides themselves or the Treasury Department to back them in the case of future panics or future crises. This would just help them to continue to grow their own footprint in the United States and ultimately globally. From the standpoint of Washington, under President Taft and also under President Wilson, who followed President Teddy Roosevelt after the panic of 1907, they both felt that there was a requirement for the standpoint of America to grow as a power in the world, to have a bank that could basically produce currency, produce a dollar in one place. Before that, it had been produced and banknotes had been used as debt through a series of different banks, so there was no consolidated central bank. So they believed that if there was a central bank of some sort in the United States, it would help American power overall and its own financial prowess in the world. So these two groups, who again were friends, were aligned, the bankers and the president. And so there was a meeting, there was a number of meetings that happened over the 1908 to 1910 period, where Nelson Aldrich, who was a senator from Rhode Island, was challenged to go to Europe and discover what the central banks were doing there, report back to the U.S. He took with him a man named James Stillman, who was the head of National City Bank. So it was a senator and a banker that went to go do this for 2 years and traipse around Europe and create reports and hang out and drink and all that sort of thing. So they come back, and it's 1910, and it's November, and Taft really wants the Federal Reserve to pass under his administration. He thinks it's a good idea. He says, get it done. I want a final report. I want to get this moving. Nelson Aldrich gets hit by a trolley car in New York. So he's meeting with the bankers. He gets hit by a trolley car. The meeting for the central bank, which ultimately happened at Jekyll Island, which was a very exclusive club off of the coast of Georgia, was almost not going to happen. But that was the place, because of the trolley car accident, that J.P. Morgan said, you know what, I got membership in this club. You guys go over there. James Stillman has been around Europe or not, so send his lieutenant, who was a man named Frank Vanderlip, also representing National City Bank, and a few men that represented the Morgan interest, and you go off to this island and sort it out, come up with your report. So after 10 days of pheasant hunting and, you know, eating Thanksgiving dinners and all sorts of things, they also come up with the Federal Reserve Act, which creates a central bank for the United States that also has a very strong influence from the Wall Street community, because four bankers and two people from Washington actually created it. In fact, Nelson Aldrich was so convalescing from the trolley car accident that he did not even present this plan to Washington. Frank Vanderlip and a man named Henry Davison, who was a partner at the Morgan Bank, actually presented the plan. So that was how tight. You didn't have lobbyists and lawyers back there. They just did it direct.
They presented what was called the Aldrich Plan. Excuse me for interrupting you.
Exactly. They presented the Aldrich plan, which was the blueprint for what became the Federal Reserve. Now, it didn't pass with Aldrich in power in the Senate, and it didn't pass under Taft. It ultimately passed under Woodrow Wilson. The same bankers, though, were promoting it and working with their friends in Washington the whole time, including friends with Wilson. Frank Vanderlip happened to have been a very old chum of Woodrow Wilson, to the extent that when Wilson was running Princeton University, him and Vanderlip used to hang out and chat. And Wilson was, he had a lot of health problems, and he has a letter that I examined as part of the archives that I watched and I investigated for Wilson, where he gives Vanderlip credit for helping him feel healthier because of the diversity of their conversations about the global system. And so this was very interesting sort of background. Anyway, it passes. The Federal Reserve Act, which is a version of the Aldrich Act, passes under Woodrow Wilson in December 1913. And that established the Federal Reserve that we have today with 12 branches, of which the most powerful one is the Wall Street branch, or it's known as the New York Fed. The members of which were the constellation of those bankers that created or very heavily involved in creating the plan. And today it remains the most powerful component, the most influential component of the Federal Reserve System, coming out of that connection to Wall Street and the New York banking community that snakes back to a century ago.
So I think people can understand the reasons there are to be uncomfortable with the fact that we have a Federal Reserve essentially designed by bankers. On the other hand, who better to sort of understand the way the financial financial system did work. I mean, should we assume that those bankers were only looking out for their own interest, or what were there some credible reasons to heavily involve them in the process?
Well, they were definitely looking out for their own reasons. They strongly believed that the concentration of power, of their decision-making, they believed very strongly in that whatever they decided for themselves would benefit the country. Now, whether it did was a separate issue. For example, after the crash in 1929, the Federal Reserve that they had created very much backed the bigger banks, as it does today, and let a lot of the smaller banks fail. And when Woodrow Wilson even promoted the idea of the Federal Reserve Act as passing to the public, he did it in a manner where he promised that this Federal Reserve would be an institution, a body that would create more credit for the smaller farming communities, for the smaller banks that were dotted throughout the country and so forth. That was how it was presented to the American people. But the reality was that over time, the Federal Reserve also served in this position of helping the bigger banks continue to consolidate, to eat up the banks that failed, or to simply have stronger lines to better financing, to cheaper money for the larger banks relative to the smaller banks. So on the one hand, the idea of it as it was presented by Wilson made some kind of sense for the general population. And having a currency backed by one institution instead of lots of multiple banks sort of jockeying for position theoretically made sense as well. But in practice, what it did was serve as a means to reinforce the power of a very concentrated few banking institutions, which are now larger today than they've ever been before, and have been that way because of these political and financial alliances from the get-go. And when you have a system in which there's a few institutions that have so much power over capital and over policy and over government, it isn't necessarily representative of a true democracy, of what's best for all the other individuals or even all the other banks that are involved in the full banking system in the country, because they just don't have the same backing that the larger banks have. They don't have the same connections, and they just don't have the same availability of money and financing at the same sort of perky level that the bigger banks have.
Tell us about the roles that the big banks have played in financing U.S. wars.
So after the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, there was a meeting that took place at the White House between Jack Morgan, who was the son now of J.P. Morgan. He died. He actually died before the Federal Reserve Act was signed, even though he had been, you know, much of the navigation before it. And at this meeting, it was July 1914. It was before World War One broke out. And there was all of this buzz, all of these reporters were at the White House, all of these papers were wondering, how is Wilson meeting with Morgan? What's going on? Because Wilson had campaigned on this notion of separating himself from Wall Street, even though he was very connected on a personal basis from these people. And that's what the population expected of him. So all of a sudden, Morgan's having this large meeting, and it's at noon, and what's going on? Morgan comes out of the meeting. He says to the press, I'm not going to talk to you, basically, because that was what he did. He was a private sort of guy. Wilson comes out and says, I had Morgan here at my pleasure. That was all he said to the press. And so more buzz came about. But a month or so later, that buzz was shown to be a conversation that happened between them that was talking about war financing, because at the time, neither the Federal Reserve, that was in its infancy, nor the Treasury Department could afford a war. Mm-hmm. But who could afford a war was the Morgan Bank and their friends and their alliances throughout Wall Street with National City and Chase and so forth. Again, all these men were connected, and they believed that it was time. It was time now for America to be in that sort of arena. And in fact, Jack Morgan is quoted in my book as saying, I think war is a good opportunity, quote unquote, for America. And because they could finance the war, and 75% of the private financing for the Allies and for the U.S. in World War One came through the Morgan Bank, which is an astonishing statistic. So their influence was very, very strong in terms of who got war supplies, what was being built for where, how it was being financed, how the country was involved in war financing through buying bonds. And so by the time we got to the Second World War, there was a lot more sort of infighting amongst the banking class, and Morgan was a little bit less involved, even though they were still involved in World War II. But now Chase and National City Bank became the two front runners of war policy and war financing. And it was a little bit more divided amongst the banks, but they were now running war bonds to the extent that they were working very heavily with FDR's Treasury Secretary Morgenthau, who they all sort of knew from, you know, back in the day, and their own social connections as well. And they were saying to individuals in the country, look, if you buy war bonds from us, which is your patriotic duty, you can, by the way, also open an account with us. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, they're financing the war. They're working very closely with the Treasury and State Department. And also a lot of bankers are going back and forth through the Department of War as well. So as opposed to today, where they're all going back and forth through the Treasury Department, then they were going through the War Department as well. So there's also a very tight connection how money was being spent, as well as raising it, as well as bringing citizens into the mix as well. And by the time the war was over, these major banks had even more deposits and more accounts open, the larger banks, because they had been the ones that were most active in creating the financing. So that's basically how both of those two wars operated. And by the time we got to the Cold War in Vietnam and so forth after, there were different alignments that these bankers had because of their connections and their collaboration in World War II that worked through the next several decades of political and financial alignments between the White House and Wall Street.
My guest is journalist Nomi Prinz. She's a former Wall Street executive and author of the new book, All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. You can be part of the discussion by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We have thank you gift copies of Nomi Prinz's book, All the President's Bankers, available when you make a contribution today to kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. We have the book available at the $120 or above contribution level. We have lots of other thank you gifts as well. We're working this hour and we're making great progress on a challenge from a friend of KERA and Dallas attorney Robert Verdon. He says he will give the station an extra $1,500 if we can raise $10,000 in contributions today on Think by the time the show ends at the end of the second hour. Help with this challenge to work with a contribution right now. We have $8,600, actually $8,601 left to go. Maybe you could give like 101 or 201 or 601 and get us down to an even number. But what we really need to get down to is zero so that we can accept this additional $1,500. Jeff Whittington is in with us once again. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And yes, the drive-in's tomorrow. Tomorrow's the last day of this membership campaign. So don't wait any longer. Please do your part right now by calling 888-694-6931 or by going online to kera.org. It's really important we hear from you during this hour of the show today. You can pick up a copy of All the President's Bankers with a $10 a month contribution, or maybe you'd like to get the KERA Care Pack with the shirt and the iced coffee cup and a couple of reusable shopping bags. That's available with a $20 a month sustaining membership. You can check all that out online at kera.org, or you can ask about it when you call 888-694-6931. And when you make your contribution, you're automatically entered to win this fantastic grand prize drawing where we're going to give away some tickets and a really special gift card.
Tickets to see Neil deGrasse Tyson, $1,000 Apple Store gift card. So you're automatically entered in that drawing, which will take place tomorrow when you make your contribution now. Looks like we've gained $500 since the last time we checked in. $8,101 left to make the challenge. Maybe somebody did $500, which would be fantastic, or some combination of several people. Your contribution in any amount counts. It brings that number down. I'll tell you, if we can get, you know, certainly under four or five thousand in this hour, I feel really confident that we will make the challenge and receive that $1,500 from Robert Verdon, because your contribution now inspires people who like to swoop in at the last second. So if you could sacrifice the thrill of swooping in at the last second to do it now, you'll guarantee that we have a last second for someone else to swoop in.
Yeah, we want to make this challenge. It's a $1,500 challenge. We've got to raise $10,000 by 2 p.m. To accept the $1,500 additional dollars from Robert Verdon. He's a Dallas attorney. He's a fan of the station. He's a fan of the Think Show. And he's a supporter of KERA, and he is hoping that he can inspire you to support the station as well. When you make your call to 888-694-6931, 888-694-6931, when you make your online donation at kera.org, you're going to help us get there, and KERA will be able to accept an additional $1,500. It's a lot of money. We don't want to leave it on the table, so please be the very next one to call, 888 888- 604-6931.
It would be fantastic to hear from a new friend of the station at the $1,500 level. That's $125 a month on the sustaining membership plan. You can also get a sustaining membership plan for $10 or $20 a month, for $5 a month, for $50 a month. You can name the amount and make a substantial contribution to the station without really feeling it all at once in your personal budget. So go online now to kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. You could see Neil deGrasse Tyson in person and get a $1,000 Apple Store gift card, all for your generosity if you win that drawing tomorrow.
Yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson, this is a sold-out event at the Windspear. The tickets that you may win are in the orchestra area. It's really a great opportunity to see him speak when
he's,
you know,
adorable.
This is a really hard ticket to get. So we have a pair of tickets for this. And of course, we've got this $1,000 Apple Store gift card. Somebody's going to win this grand prize drawing. It could be you. You're automatically entered when you make your contribution at 888-694-6931 or when you go online to kera.org. Check out the thank you gifts that are available there. We've also got this very popular the Leave No Trace combo. You give $10 a month as a sustaining member of the station. We'll make sure that 5 trees get planted in your honor as part of the National Forest Reforestation Project. And we'll throw in 2 KERA reusable shopping bags that you can, you know, not use up as many resources when you're doing your shopping. And you can use those KERA reusable bags and people will know that you've supported public radio.
888-694-6931 or kera.org. Making terrific progress thanks to you. $7,101 left to go. Maybe you can bring us down below that number. That would be really fantastic. Your contribution to the station pays for programs like the one you're listening to right now, like the ones you turn on and hear every day, every hour of every day on KERA. All of it is paid for by people just like you and me and Jeff. We're members of the station. We hope you're a member of the station. Down to $6,807, $6,807 left to raise in order to receive this challenge.
Yeah, our goal is $10,000 during the 2 hours of Think Today. We got to raise $10,000 to accept a $1,500 additional gift from Dallas attorney Robert Verdon. Please be the next one to call 1-888-694-6931. It's a toll-free number, 888-694-6931, or contribute at kera.org.
Your contribution really matters, and it especially matters now. Plus, you'll get into that drawing. $6,707 left to raise. Jump in there now. We appreciate it. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Nomi Prinz.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Nomi Prinz, whose new book is called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we hear from Clark in Weatherford. Hello, Clark.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is just fascinating, this lady. What's her name again?
Nomi Prinz.
Nomi. Mm-hmm. Is she there? Nomi?
She's here.
Okay.
I'm here, Clark.
Okay. I'm looking at a list of things. I got this Sir Thomas Gresham's Law. He lived from 1519 to 1579. His economic principle was that bad money drives out good.
That's very true. The problem is, I mean, the reason for that is, and even till this day, hundreds of years later, is that the more consolidation of power and unaccountability for that power, or the ability to speculate with the money that's controlled or the capital that's controlled. And today, it's not even just money in terms of physical gold-backed money or anything like this. We're talking about derivatives and all sorts of esoteric forms of money that make this situation even worse. And that makes it harder for individuals to invest. It makes it harder, for example, banks are getting money at 0% interest right now from the Federal Reserve, whereas individuals now are getting 0% on their savings rate, which is a much harder thing for people to deal with in their own deposit accounts, whereas they're paying 15 or 20 or 25% on credit cards. So all of this instability also dials down into people's pockets. So this continues to consolidate hundreds of years later. So we're aware of what's going on. You know, it's a question of continuing to push that awareness and doing something about it.
Okay, the Glass-Steagall Act, of course, separates out banking functions so that you can't have commercial banking and investment banking together, or you couldn't during the time that Glass-Steagall existed. How did it originally come about, and how did FDR wield his influence on bankers in order to make it happen?
Well, the very interesting thing that I did not know until I went to the FDR Library and examined the records between FDR and men like Winthrop Aldrich, who were running Chase, and James Perkins, who came to run National City Bank and so forth at the time, these men, before FDR even discussed the Glass-Steagall Act, had visited him in Washington, in particular James Perkins, 5 days after FDR had gotten inaugurated, and they had discussed separating their own banks. Before the Glass-Steagall Act was signed, which was in June of that year, so this was in March, and they had announced to their shareholders and to the New York Times and so forth that they would separate their own banks. And the reason they wanted to do that was twofold. One is that they truly realized there was a banking crisis of confidence, which there was in the country, as did FDR. He spoke of it in his inaugural address. They were also very much on the side of FDR. They were friends with FDR. They wanted him to give them his power, and they wanted to, in turn, give him their power. And part of that lay in separating and detaching speculation from depositors in the country. And it worked. The Glass-Steagall Act was passed. It was discussed under President Hoover before FDR even came into office. It was promoted by these bankers. Winthrop Aldrich took out a front page article in the New York Times to talk about why this was important from the standpoint of stability in America, which they believe was also important for stability and growth of America and the globe as well, as did FDR. And it created a much more stable environment for individuals in the country. Thousands of banks had been failing until this point, and speculation was very dangerous and had been the big problem that had caused all of these failures and had caused the market to crash and had lost people so much money. And so in the decades that follow the passage of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated depositors' money from speculation and other types of practices of that nature, created a much more confined, restrained banking environment. But during that time, banks were still growing. The big six banks were still able to grow globally and have FDR support and later Truman support and Eisenhower support through Kennedy and a little bit less Kennedy. That's a separate story. And LBJ support and so forth. So they were able to do both, care about the confidence in banking and the stability in the country, as well as become more profitable amongst themselves. And FDR knew this. He knew this from the beginning. He knew he could get them on his side, and they wanted him on their side. And that's really how it worked. It was a collaboration that we don't really hear about without. I didn't know about it. I've been talking about this stuff for over a decade until I looked at how tight the communications were on passing the Glass-Steagall Act. Winthrop Aldrich was FDR's man in Washington to push Carter Glass, whose name is on that act, to make the Glass-Steagall Act even stronger than it was originally going to be.
Let's talk about JFK, because bankers lobbied him to move off the gold standard, and he was not interested.
Yeah, exactly. Bankers, as these decades went through, realized that restraints were one thing in terms of their construction, speculation versus deposits. But if they couldn't use the deposits to speculate, they needed another form. They needed other ways of raising money in order to grow and to expand. And one way would be to get off of the gold standard. Because if you have anything restraining you, whether it's a regulation and you're a banker, or it's gold, where you have to reserve a physical asset against the types of transactions that you do, it limits your activities. And so they didn't want their activities to be limited. So they did lobby JFK to get off of the gold standard. And they almost got him to decide to do so. One of the main lobbyists was David Rockefeller. And he actually took on JFK in a 1962 Life magazine article, which was very fascinating, where he talked about all of his ideas for the world and for getting off of gold and all of these sorts of things. And JFK was in this position. He knew Rockefeller from decades before that. They'd actually met in 1938 at a coming out party for JFK's sister Kathleen at the time. time, and she even dated David Rockefeller for a minute in London. So there were ties there, but they were both very strong-minded individuals. And JFK really believed, with respect to gold and with respect to Latin America, which was the other component of David Rockefeller's push, that it was important for the strength of the U.S. as well as for the strength of countries in, with which the U.S. was trading, that they have sort of a level playing field. And this was one way to do that. Whereas opening Latin America for more private investment or taking the U.S. off the gold standard was a way to basically put more power in the hands of these banks. And he didn't see that as being a rational thing to do, even though he supported them in general. And he just didn't see that as the right policy. David Rockefeller had very different views on this. By the time Nixon came aboard, you know, in 1971 and took the country off of the Glass-Steagall Act, off of the gold standard, David Rockefeller and another man named Walter Wriston, who was the head of National Citibank, now Citigroup, were very much lobbying for years to get the country off of the gold standard to allow banks to have easier access to whatever transactions they wanted to do and easier forms of money without these constraints of hard asset behind it.
Was the collaboration between the Fed and U.S. banks during the most recent crisis unprecedented in terms of scope in American history?
It is. It remains unprecedented. There's never been a period after or into any war where financing was required and where, as I mentioned before, a lot of the banks were involved in this financing, where there was a zero interest rate policy for so long. So the idea of having basically no cost to money for the biggest banks has never happened to this extent for these many years. In addition, the subsidy of the Federal Reserve buying securities from the banking system to the extent that they have, the fact that they have $4.2 trillion, you know, it's about a quarter of our GDP, quarter of our debt on the books of the Federal Reserve from taking them from the books of the banks to allow the banks to have extra room to continue to do what they do, as well as to have extra cash with which to do it, is also unprecedented. Before the 2008 crisis, you know, you had a couple hundred billion, not 4.2 trillion. And this is all money that's not being used into the general economy. In addition to that, there's a regulation that the Fed imposes on its member banks that says they have to put some reserve money. It's not gold anymore, but some reserve money on the books for a rainy day, on the books of the Fed. It's a very small amount of money. It's a stupidly small amount of money. It's $80 billion. It's tiny anyway. It doesn't fix anything. But what the banks have done is instead of just putting up $80 billion, they've put up $2.5 trillion. In other words, they have $2.5 trillion of cash with the Fed doing absolutely nothing with respect to the individual customers or small businesses or anything else of these particular banks. Literally doing nothing except getting a quarter of a percent interest rate from the Fed, which was something that was still in the 2008 period of the subprime crisis. And so this whole level of support, and this is infiltrated Europe as well. So the ECB has done the same thing in terms of buying securities, not to the extent that the Fed has. It's also having rates near zero, not as long as the Fed has had. But this whole idea subsidizing the major banks in these systems emanating from the U.S. and the unprecedented involvement of the Federal Reserve and the allowance to do this by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration are completely unprecedented.
Naomi Prinz is a former Wall Street executive who now works as a journalist and commentator. Her new book is called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Naomi, really fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you very much. And good luck with the drive. This is fascinating. I'm very excited about the numbers you were talking about.
Thank you.
It's very important.
We're excited, too. I appreciate it. Thanks to all of you who are listening and who have given us these exciting numbers. We are down to $5,538 left to raise in order to receive the additional $1,500 challenge grant offered by Dallas attorney Robert Verdon, good friend of KERA. He will give the station that money if by the end of Think Today, so we've got about an hour and 7 minutes, 6 or 7 minutes, we can raise a total of $10,000 or more. We'd really love to get this number under 4,000 by the end of this hour, because we have slightly more listeners in the first hour of the show than the second hour, typically, because people have to go back from lunch sometimes or take their lunch earlier. Your contribution now will make a big difference at KERA.org or 888-694-6931. Hi, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank a few people here for helping us get where we are right now. Christine Renee Howard in Dallas and Ryan Hawkins in Dallas. We heard from Ms. Lee Verdon in Fort Worth and Faye Meschke in Frisco and Kristen Robertson in Colleyville and Alexander Tollison in Dallas. Also, Fred Halstead in Dallas, Thanks also to Derek Martin in Irving and Kevin Christensen in Dallas.
Your contribution can be added to theirs and will get us closer to this challenge. And you can feel great about not only your contribution itself, but about knowing that you made it possible for KERA to receive this additional money. And that additional money goes to work for you, providing great radio, great journalism coverage all over the community and all over the planet. $5,478 left to raise. Please add your contribution now at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. When you do that, we will write down your name, fold it up, and put it in the vessel that we have. I have to figure out if this is a box or a hopper.
It's your office, actually. It's
dump it in my office.
It's full of paper.
And someone will pull a winner tomorrow who will receive 2 tickets to see Neil deGrasse Tyson and a $1,000 Apple Store gift card. So when you do this good thing for yourself and your community and for KERA, you will also get a chance to win an awesome prize.
Yeah, this is a $1,000 Apple gift card. Our producers gave us a list of things that you could pick up at the Apple Store, including a MacBook Air, any iPod, any iPhone, any iPad, or maybe a collection of those devices, depending on which ones you choose, all kinds of stuff. I mean, think about what all there is at the Apple Store that you could get with a $1,000 gift card. Also, these Neil deGrasse Tyson tickets, this show is sold out, and we've got a couple of seats in the orchestra section. It's at the Windspear, right? That's where you might be with your new phone in your pocket and maybe... maybe some new speakers back at the house if you win this drawing.
It's fun to think about what you would do if you were wandering through that gleaming Apple store. It's great to imagine seeing Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's been in here a couple of times, Jeff, mm-hmm. and he's delightful. You've seen him probably on TV and heard him on the radio. Very smart and really the sort of person who kind of leaves you inspired after you've heard him speak. So we would love for you to win this. Somebody's got to win. Why not get your name into the drawing now by going online and making a contribution at kera.org or calling 1-888-694-6931.
Don't forget Robert Verdon, a Dallas attorney, a friend of KERA, and a big supporter of the station, has issued a challenge today to encourage you to contribute during Think. He will give KERA an additional $1,500 if we can raise $10,000 total in contributions by 2 p.m. So that's a 2-hour challenge. $10,000 is the goal. You can help us achieve this with your contribution right now at 888-694-6931. We're almost halfway there. $5,400 and change left to raise. Make your call right now to 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Just takes a couple of minutes. You can pick up a Think mug if you join at the $5 a month membership level. You can pick up a copy of Naomi Prinz's book, All the President's Bankers, if you join with a $10 a month contribution. But what's important is that you join right now because we still need to raise $5,418 by 2 p.m. In order to make this goal and get this extra $1,500 from Robert Verdon.
Lots of you have already answered the call. We appreciate those of you who have done so. If you haven't yet taken action, make this the time because this challenge is tied specifically to Think. It is for listeners to this program. So if you try never to miss the show or you catch it on podcast or you recommend it to people or you derive your reading list maybe from listening to Think, this is the perfect time for you to make your contribution in support of the program. 888-694-6931 or kera.org down to $5,293. That's how far away we are from achieving the challenge.
Thanks to Vicki Weiss in Fort Worth and Joan Carroll in Fort Worth. Also Charles Watley in McKinney. We heard from, and oh thanks to, John Willis in Dallas and Danielle Forsyth in Irving, and also Joshua and Jocelyn Ashley over in Garland. Thank you so much to each and every one of you. We'd love to thank you when you call 888-694-6931. Don't miss out on the opportunity to help KERA not only conclude this drive successfully, but make this challenge today. $10,000 is what we got to raise by 2 p.m. $5,293 left, and if we make it, when we make it, we'll be able to accept an additional $1,500 from KERA listener, friend, and Dallas attorney Robert Verdon.
We've got something really special coming up in hour two. It's a whole hour about bumblebees and their really fascinating qualities and why they seem to be disappearing from the landscape in many places and what we might do about that. It's a great example of the diversity of topics that we cover on the show. Hour one is banking and politics. Hour two is bumblebees and science. But your contribution to KERA.org or to 1-888-694-6931 makes it all possible. $5,293 left to raise. Please make your contribution now, and we can get this challenge. Thanks.